differential geometry. So G will be a complex reductive group. So typically GLN or SLN, that's fine. And U is a maximal unipotent subgroup. So for GLN, this is or SLN, this is one on the diagonal, anything above the diagonal and zero below the diagonal. And the space we're interested in is G mod U. And so I'm going to talk about two results. There are two objects which are different but yet closely related. One is related to one result and the other to the other one, and somehow the interplay between them, although the results themselves apparently have nothing to do with each other. One is about differential operators and the other is about the Sicilian theories, but it turns out that somehow the answer looks almost identical, although. Okay, now the object I'm interested in is the algebra, the non-commutative algebra of algebraic differential operators on G mod U. So algebraic.
On G mod U.
And the first result, maybe before I do the result, so I'll denote by W the Weyl group all the time. And the first result is a theorem discovered by Gelfand and Greif in 1960s. Says that there exists a natural action of the Weyl group on this algebra by algebra automorphisms. Now let's see what happens. So the basic case is the case where G is SL2. So U is just 1, 1, something zero, and then G mod U is, so this group is the stabilizer of a vector in C2. Of element. And so G mod U is the orbit of a non-zero vector in C2, and this is every vector except zero. Okay. And so when you look at the differential operators on G mod U, so these are algebraic differential operators, or holomorphic by that matter. But the point is that, so this is d by dx with polynomial coefficients times d by dy. But the point is that whenever function you take, it automatically extends across the puncture because by Hartogs. So this ring is actually the ring of differential operators on C2, just polynomial differential operators. The ring does not know that there is no zero here. And on that ring, so this is two generators, two functions, and two partials. And then it has an operation of Fourier transform when it flips the partials. And this is the action of the Weyl group, which is Z mod 2. So W is Z mod 2 acts on this Fourier transform. So Fourier takes, let's say, x to d by dx. There may be some minus sign, I don't care. It doesn't matter. Now, the point is that this action does not come from any action on G mod U itself. And there cannot possibly be any action because somehow, it's not a geometric action. All right, so now the way, although this theorem was proved in 1960s, and the way it was proved, and until to this was, so one of our goals was to understand what's going on, because all the proofs, basically the only proof available was the original one, and they you can use this argument to construct the action of each simple reflection by reducing to a minimal parabolic, but then it comes to a mess to check that they really satisfy the relations inside the wild group, and this can be done in various ways, but all of the ways are kind of mess. There's no clean way to do it. It's a symplectic Fourier transform, so it is of order 2, because actually it's SL2, so it is a volume. And symplectic Fourier transform has order 2. All right, so this was one motivation. And so you see that this object shows up naturally. Now, the other story comes with the Sicilian theory. So here I'm not definitely not an expert. So we've discovered it with Kasdan by reading this paper by Moore and Tachikawa. So this is 2011. Obviously, there were some earlier constructions using Gaiota and then probably Whitman, and I'm not an expert who is doing what. So anyway, this has to do with something which is called TQFT with values in holomorphic symplectic manifolds. What this story is about the Higgs branch, and the Higgs branch of the story is supposed to be the following. It's an assignment or a functor, whatever you call it. So you take for each Riemann surface, sigma, with punctures, one is supposed to assign a symplectic manifold. So this is the Higgs branch. M of sigma. So this is supposed to be, to satisfy among other things, the following properties. So it's supposed to be symplectic, holomorphic symplectic. And it carries an action of as many copies of the group G. So everything is we have a fixed group G as before. Such a guy is supposed to have Hamiltonian actions of several copies of G, one for each puncture. So with Hamiltonian. Action of punctures. If I write, my running notation now is what I write the German G for the Lie algebra of G, and G star is for the dual space. And so if I have a Hamiltonian action, I have moment maps. So I have moment map. These actions commute, it's a product. I have a moment map from my M of sigma to a product of copies of G star over the punctures. There are various properties. For instance, there's also required to be a rescaling action which rescales the symplectic form, but so the crucial property is a kind of gluing property. What happens if you glue two surfaces? This property is as follows. So suppose I have it is a usual axiom which ensures that this is a TQFT. So it's the following. So suppose I have two surfaces, one and two. So this is sigma, and this is sigma prime. And so here I have a marked point, which I denoted by like this little thing, but this is really a marked point here. And there's a similar marked point here. And I want to glue them at this marked point. So there's a preferred, among all the mark points here, there's a preferred one which I pick, and I want to glue it at this mark point here. And there's a similar point here. Now then, the corresponding, the result of this thing will be denoted by, I'll write it as sigma, star sigma prime over z. And the axiom says how is the manifold associated to this is related to these two. And the axiom is the following, so that so what you do, you ignore all the moment maps and all the group actions except the point we're picking it. And so for each of those two, we have the moment map to the corresponding copy of G star. And so all together you have a map. So you have a map like mu times mu prime. I'll just write mu times mu from this M of sigma cross M of sigma prime to G star cross G star. And now you can take the sum, or I'm not sure about the sign, so you have to make the sign right. So you look at the diagonal action of G on both. And this corresponds for the moment map either taking sum or product, difference, I don't remember. Anyway, and then you take the Hamiltonian reduction with respect to this diagonal action. And so the axiom says that, the axiom is that M of sigma star sigma prime over z has to be, there should be a, this data should be equipped with canonical isomorphisms of M of sigma. And now I will introduce the notation I will be keeping all the time. So Hamiltonian reduction with respect to an action will be denoted by, I think this is triple slash G. Yeah, everything is smooth, just literally smooth. It's not, but I mean, in particular, it's supposed to be like that.
So what level do you
think? Zero. Well, yeah, so when the level will be not zero, I will write it. So whenever I don't like triple slash mod group means zero level with respect to the group. So explicitly, it's just, so basically what it means is you have two moment maps. You take, maybe one time I will write it down because it's, So you take the set of elements, so let's say M in M of sigma and M prime in M of sigma prime, such that mu of M is equal to mu of M prime, and just divide by G. So just take the fiber product over G star and divide by G. I write it down because this will show up. Okay. All right. So now if so right. So basically by some standard thing, it's clear that at least to be able to define such a theory, it suffices to define it for a pair of pens, provided some axioms are satisfied. And if you, so it's sufficient, so everything boils down to explain what manifolds, which I'll denote by M sub n, correspond to the following thing. So it's M of a sphere with n punctures. So of S2 with n punctures. It's a sequence of spaces, one for each n equal to 1, 2, 3, 4, with certain axioms. That's all. Once you have this, you can cook it up for any sigma. I mean, that's what TQF guarantees us. But in fact, I will essentially, n mark points. I will, the theory result is what are they? I will give a completely explicit formula. So n is 1, 2, 3. Maybe I will say a couple of words towards the end when I come to open problems somehow. Maybe I'll, so far there's no mystery. It's just a very explicit manifold. So the question is to write them down. And so this, has, just by writing out the axiom, this should satisfy the following properties, that if I glue M sub M with in this way, so I will call this, well, maybe I should write it down. So M sub M times M sub N Hamiltonian reduction by G should be isomorphic to M plus N minus 2. That's what it is. So basically, I have to produce a sequence of spaces with these data. And in addition, because we are in a situation where we have a sphere and all points are equivalent, so in order to be exactly equivalent to the original setting, this space also have to have an action of the permutation group of n letters, which permute the points and respect commutes with the g action. And so there should be also one should have a natural action of the symmetric group, let's call it sigma n, which on this Mn, so which permutes the G actions. And also, so it is, I mean, that's what how the Moore and Tachikawa formulated it. It is, I mean, since I will write everything explicitly, everything will be obvious. So I don't want to. Anyway, now on physical grounds, they knew. Now somehow, if you look at this formula, you see that you can, once you know a small these spaces, you can, I mean, produce the other ones just by using the formula. So basically, the crucial one is 1, 2, and 3. And 2 does not change the index. And it is kind of unit in this in some monoidal structure, and so from this you immediately see that it has to what it has to be. I won't say it because it's not very relevant for me now. Now, 1 is what physicists for some reason knew what it should be, and it's called a numpole, and I will write it in a second. So basically, the only unknown thing is M sub 3. But in the construction I'm going to produce, it's as cheap to go to M3 as to any other one. So I'll do them all uniformly. But 1 is the input ingredient, so I will and that's why it's related to the previous stuff in my talk. So this is basically the language. So the space M sub 1, so the space corresponding to just one puncture, is called the principal, I don't know, well, in the physics literature, this is called the principal numpole. I will write what it is in a second, but somehow the point now, I have to apologize, so I decided to make the following strategy in my presentation. So although this is not a conference, it's a geometric conference, not an algebra, so people are expected to hate algebra. But nonetheless, it turns out that, as in Gelfand-Gray theorem, I started with a non-commutative algebra, and that's how it was formulated. But here, it's a geometric setting, but in fact, the cleanest answer is you in the quantum world. So I will give the answer in the quantized version, where all these manifolds are quantized to certain non-commutative algebras, and then I can write an explicit formula. And it's explicit, so I don't have to explain anything. And then retranslating it back to geometry actually takes more time than, and that's the whole story. So now I will write in a quantum. I will remind what is the quantum version of this. So this is whatever it is. It's a symplectic manifold, and so it has a ring of. It's an affine symplectic manifold, very small, simple one. So it has the ring of functions, and I'll tell you what the quantization of this. Yes, it is affine. Yeah. So
is affine in the story?
I will get to this. Okay. So quantization. Yeah. So to define it, I need to more notation. So let me. So now we have this also standard representation theory thing. We need to fix a non-degenerate character of the unipotent group, which is this Whittaker thing. So non-degenerate. Character psi, so in the mathematical literature of the unipotent group, C. Now for GLN, it means that I take, so my group, group element looks like this, and then I look at the, all that matters is the diagonal right above the principal diagonal, and so I have un minus 1, and then something, and then 0, and this goes to u1 plus un minus 1. Or you can put some non-zero coefficients anywhere. So this is a homomorphism, a character of this group. And then once you have such a character, it makes sense to introduce the ring of psi twisted differential operators, which I'll denote by d psi of g mod u. Now, I mean, heuristically, it's the ring of differential operators which acts, so operators which act on functions on G, well, on the induced representation for this character, so it's on functions from G to F, from G to C, such that which satisfy the property that G F of G U is equal to psi of U F of G. Okay, so this is an induced. So this is the group. I don't know. Okay, yeah. So I will interchangeably use the Lie algebra in the group. So here it's the group set. Now there's a little issue here because, of course, this character is not. There are no algebraic. Well, I want to make sure that this is actually an algebraic object and not, since there are some exponentials involved. Thank you. Yes. Exp. Acting on this.
In the section of
this. But this has to be more. This is really a cheating at this point because these are not algebraic functions. These are only, there's an exponential involved, so it's not a purely algebraic object. But in fact, the ring itself can be defined purely algebraically as a quantum Hamiltonian reduction, and I will basically say it in a few minutes. So anyway, this is a purely algebraic object, and the fact is that you can see immediately from the construction that the quantization of the algebra of functions on the symplectic manifold is this. So,
is it easy to say what that's the M1?
I will write it. So this is a quantization of functions on M1. Now, at this point, I will try to avoid answering your question as much as I can. So throughout, but at least one thing that I should definitely say is that. So now somehow now you see at least the main characters. In the first theorem, you have the honest, genuine differential operators on G mod U. And then this Sicilian business, you have those psi differential operators. And somehow the whole point of the whole story is the interplay between these two. They are not the same, but obviously they're very close to each other in some sense. And the point is to relate them to each other. And this turns out to be very interesting. So now, it's a generic character, right? Choose one and fix it. It doesn't matter. It's not just regular. Choose any regular character. Regular means that all coefficients in this, so you could write, this is kind of standard representation. So you can fix constants C1. So you could write C1 U1, so exp. C1 U1 plus Cn minus 1 Un minus 1 for any fixed C1 Cn minus 1. Where, the only condition that none of them has to be 0, can be 0. So, and then, in fact, they are conjugate by the action of the maximal torus, so it doesn't matter. So such that So this is a standard thing in representation theory, again, going to Gelfand probably and Greif also to the same people, but for totally different reasons somehow. So one has to choose a generic error. So anyway, so now I'm writing something which is kind of clear. So the ring of differential operators on G mod U is, of course, a sort of quantization of the cotangent bundle on G mod U. This is clear. Of functions on T star G mod U. Now, the answer to Tamar's question is that the ring of psi differential operators on G mod U is the quantization of functions on the psi cotangent bundle on G mod U. Now, then, of course, this is cheating. You have to figure out what this is. But this is a simple exercise. So if you write what is this, so this is a, so now, since I'm not a real answer, I'm just writing, you know how to write the cotangent bundle to a homogeneous space. So in the standard notation, it's this, where so B is the Borel. Maybe I should write it here. So B, so we have U, and it contains in B, it's a Borel, in G. And so B is the, so the, I'll write, I don't know, this is supposed to be little German U. So this is the Lie algebra of U, and this is little German B is the Lie algebra of B, and using Killing form, etc. So as a vector bundle, it's this associated bundle, and as a vector bundle, so I just take it as the definition. It's G times over U, and here you make a shift. You take psi becomes the principal nilpotent element. I will get to this later, but in any case, this is something defined by an explicit formula. So the psi enters, maybe at the moment I just keep psi. So psi enters as a shift of the fiber. So it's yes, I mean, but you don't see it from, this is on the nose, this is a holomorphic symplectic manifold. But the hyperkalometric metric is only visible as by Donaldson in the old Kronheimer, I mean, even in the cotangent bundle case, I mean, you have to use the num equation to see it. So, at least as far as I know. So it's a kind of shifted version. So the only difference is that this is a vector bundle and this is an affine bundle. So the fibers are affine space. So it's, and then you can write whatever. Now, so maybe, right. Right, so now I promised, so basically I will explain both, so the statement which immediately implies Gelfand and Greif theorem and the construction of these guys in the quantum case. Now, and for that I need a strange construction from undergraduate algebra, which it's supposed to be a Hamiltonian, quantum Hamiltonian reduction, but in a slightly non-standard setting. So I will leave it as an exercise. I may give a statement and leave it to you as an exercise to actually put it in the framework of Hamiltonian reduction. So let me do it. So, So the setting is as follows. I have a triple of associative algebras, which I'll denote by Z, A1, and A2, and they form the following diagram. So these are maps, algebra homomorphisms. So associative algebras. And these are homomorphisms. Now, I want to do the following. Somehow, I want to take Hamiltonian reduction of A1 times A2 over Z. What does that mean? So this means the following. I take A1 tensor A2 over Z. Now, this is not an algebra because Z is just, it doesn't really matter whether these maps are injective or not. But in any case, Z is not central in either there or there. So tensor product is not, it's not an algebra. But now the object I want to introduce is this. And this is by definition the following. So now what is, first of all, what is a tensor product? You take elements of the form A1 tensor A2, maybe linear combinations, up to the equivalence that whenever you multiply this by an element of Z, you can move it to this far. But now this upper Z means that you can count kind of, so this is like a quotient of tensor product by some relation. And this is a subs in that tensor product. So this is all elements of the form, I mean, something, I don't know, B in this A1 tensor A2 Z, such that Z B is equal to BZ for every Z. And the little exercise that this inherits a natural algebra structure. So without taking Z, there's no multiplication. It's only a bimodule with respect to the left action on A1 and right action of A2. But if you take this subspace, it's well-defined, and you see the flavor of, so an exercise how to interpret this as a Hamiltonian reduction. Okay, good. So now Hamiltonian, so claim is this A1 inherits an algebra structure. Okay, now I'll be using it in two different settings, but very similar one. One would prove Gelfand theorem, and the other would produce the construction of these manifolds. So, okay. So now, so here is what I will do. So first of all, this will be the enveloping algebra of G. Now Z will be the center of the enveloping algebra. And now if my group G acts on somewhere, then of course the enveloping algebra maps into differential operators in there. This is clear. And so we have, in particular, we have, so my Z is a subalgebra of UG. And now we have two spaces. One is the differential operators on G mod U, and UG maps there as differential operators. But also, of course, this also holds for twisted version, so we also have a homomorphism here. So this is one setting. Now, the second ingredient is the maximal torus. So T is a maximal torus. In G. So T is the Cartan subalgebra. And so what do I need from this? Right, and I will, classical thing is the Harishchandra isomorphism, which identifies the center of the universal enveloping algebra with W invariant elements in the symmetric algebra. So the Cartan algebra is commutative, so we can think of it either as an enveloping algebra of T or as the symmetric algebra of T. And inside here, we have W invariants. And the Harishchandra isomorphism tells me that this is canonically isomorphic to the center of the enveloping algebra. So this is Harishchandra. But also now I can think of elements of T as in constant vector fields on the torus itself. And so all this sets as constant coefficient operators inside the differential operators on T. Okay. Just this translation invariant. And now the first main result, which implies Gelfand-Graev, is the following formula. So there exists a natural isomorphism, algebra isomorphism. So the thing we want to describe is differential operators on U. And what you do is you interpret it in terms of psi differential operators. So you take it as d psi g mod u tensor over z d of t. Oh, this is the formula. Now, in the right-hand side, the W action is on the nose. It's the action of W on this. But this is highly not obvious. Huh? Psi is, it's a generic, I fix, as long, I mean, everything is independent of which choice you do. I fix someone.
Yeah, but the wolf.
You know, don't even think about it. So, there.
But the statement is that psi independent.
This is not even a statement. I mean, this is something obvious. I don't want to know. This is some basics about.
So it's obvious that it's psi independent.
Yeah. This is obvious from, yeah. There is some action, conjugation action of the maximal torus, which conjugates all psi's, rescales the coefficients, this C1 up to Cn in psi. So it's completely obvious.
But
so.
Left psi is
0. Yes. Yeah, but 0 is, I mean, whenever I write psi, all the coordinates of psi are non-zero. They're not allowed to be 0. Here it's identically 0. It's a totally different matter. And I will, so the GG action in the left-hand side it corresponds under this isomorphism to the W action on D of t. Now, W does act on T, so the action on D of T is a geometric action. Okay. All right. So maybe, right. So maybe we'll see how I go. So maybe first, before I make any more comments, I will now give the construction in the similar spirit of this. Of this Sicilian construction, and then go to the geometry, and then we'll see all the comments.
Sorry, one question: this what does that? If psi is identity on the right, does it still hold?
No. Whenever I write psi, it cannot be degenerate.
If somebody else writes psi,
it will, everything will be false. Just no. This is very specific for my. I could write psi to be 1, 1, 1, 1. If you wish, call it psi and never discuss it again. Okay, it's a specific. So. Okay, so I'll let me do the quantum, this one first. So now, here. So as I promised, I will explain how to construct the quantum algebras corresponding to this. So again, they will be given by a very simple, similar formula. So let me do this. And you will see that. So I already said that the quantum for M1, the algebra is this. So now I will introduce the, basically adjust the notation I introduced there. And so now I will introduce the following space. So now we will go back to this Sicilian business. So we take the following space. So I will introduce just to shorthand. So this is a d psi g mod u. And this is the same as the quantization of principal non-pole. And so then the formula is this. So I want to define the quantization of this m sub n for any n greater than or equal to 1. And so this is defined by the following formula. I first write it and then explain. So you write d psi tensor z, d psi tensor z, d psi, and go on. n times. And then according to our strategy, we have to put the upper z as many times as you put the lower z. And so just at the moment, I just do it. And I really don't know whether I should put the tensor or cross. In any case, I have to explain what this means. Now, this means the following. So the thing inside the parenthesis is clear. It's not what it is. Now, what is, and so what does this mean? So we discussed in, before there was only one z in here and one z here. Now here we have more z's as subscripts and more z's as superscripts. So for the subscripts, it's clear. It's just each of these guys has a right and left action. So we tensor as they stand.
Everywhere?
Yes, everywhere. Yeah, everywhere. It's supposed to be symmetric with respect to permutations of n, of the factor. So that's therefore it has to be. Okay. Now all I have to explain is what this means. So this means the following. I don't know. So I have something sitting here. So let me symbolically write it as a U1 tensor U2 up to UN. And now so there are several factors. So it means the following. I pick some position, let's say, I plus one. Okay? And then so we have some ui here and tensor ui plus one here. And so the factor, so this you should think of them as like z12, z23, and so on. And when I go to the effect of putting the upper zii plus one means that I require that I only take elements such that this is equal to, well, whatever, what you can imagine. And this is for every z and every I from 1 to n minus 1. So inside this tensor product in here, I take only those elements which satisfy these equations for every position I. Every subsequent position. So somehow this tensor product here allows me to move from the right factor on here to the left factor here, and then somehow goes from here to here.
And when you write this equation, that's the same as writing this equation without the current.
As what?
If I write this equation without the current, that's the same.
I mean, there are other use. I simply don't know what's the good notation for it to somehow the action. What I mean is that the action is on the ith factor here.
So you can erase the parent.
I can. I don't. Right. But you remember that this equation holds only when it's not. It's in the equation is for elements which are already in the tensor product. So we already modded out. Somehow this is the same thing here. You impose. You mod out by something when you. With respect to the inner action, and then you impose the equality with respect to the outer action. And this is what.
So this equality only holds up to.
Up to. That's exactly how Hamiltonian reduction works. It's you take an equation up to. It's a non-commutative version of this procedure. Okay, good. So that's it. That's the answer. So and then you can formulate quantizations of all the axioms they wrote, and they immediately follow from this definition on the nose. Okay, now this is the end of the algebraic story. Now I really have to explain what's really going on. So I will erase everything. So now we'll go back to geometry. And it turns out that there's a very beautiful and very classical geometry which seems to have been completely overlooked in the business related to geometry of flag varieties, Springer resolutions, and things like that. And now that's what I want to explain. Now, so geometry. So first of all, the first important ingredient is a so-called universal centralizer or regular centralizer. So we consider the following set. So we take elements gx from g times g star such that, basically x is a point in g star, and I take those g's which fix this x. Well, usually, if I keep this star, but in fact, G is reductive, so usually one can identify G with G star, and this is really the centralizer of X. And so this is a, so they have a projection of this guy to G star, and this is a group scheme over G star. And this is called the universal centralizer group scheme. And I will denote A sub G, so this is a centralizer group scheme. So the fiber over a point here is the centralizer of that element. So it moves along with the point. Now, we have the following obvious observation. So suppose now we have GU, let G act on some symplectic manifold with moment map. G act Hamiltonianly. On M, and so we have the moment map. Then we have the following observation, which is kind of obvious, that, well, the moment map itself is a G-equivariant map. But in fact, there is a residual action, so the centralizer also acts on M along the fibers. So the moment map, I mean, the G action, so for each point, the stabilizer of that point acts on the fiber of this map. And this gives me an action of this H on M. And this action commutes with the G action, because once you, in the sense that this is a group scheme with equipped with a G action, and so it acts on this, and when you, everything is compatible with the action of G. Okay? So we have, so whenever you have a Hamiltonian action with a moment map, you automatically have an action, in addition to somehow G action on M, you automatically also have a commuting action of this A. So F. Now, in general, this is not very useful because this A is complicated. However, Kostand told us that if we restrict to the set of regular elements, then things become much nicer. So, Kostand says the following, that, so first of all, let's consider, I need annotation. So we consider, maybe before Kostand. So let me consider the adjoint quotient map. So just a categorical quotient, right, like that. So it's the same as Cartan mod W. And inside here, we have a subset of regular elements. Regular element. So regular means not necessarily semi-simple. So for instance, Jordan block of maximal size is fine. And then Kostand tells us the following, that the map GR to T mod W is smooth, and each fiber is exactly one orbit of maximal dimension. So let me call it pi. This is my pi fiber. Yes, one orbit. This group scheme A sub G, when you restrict it to regular elements, descends to here. Descends to a, yes, and I, from now on, before I forget it, so from now on, I assume that my group G has trivial center, so PGL rather than SL. So descends to a commutative. Flat group scheme A without a subscript on this. And I'll write German A for this quotient on A. And also A is connected if G has no center. And so this A is called the universal centralizer. So it's a flat group scheme on A. Okay, and now this is has funny picture, namely this group scheme A has a sort of Hamiltonian flavor, but in a kind of one has to move your hand 90 degrees to understand that. So what you can do, you can take the Lie algebra of this A. But now what is it's a group scheme. So the Lie algebra of a group scheme means that you take the Lie algebra of each fiber. Now when you get, so it's a vector bundle on A. And the fact is that this vector bundle is the cotangent bundle to A. So this is kind of, that's why you have to move your hand, because usually if you take the cotangent bundle to a group, so the group is the base and then there are fibers. But here it's kind of the cotangent directions are from the base and the group is in the fibers, because the group moves, I mean the group changes. So I don't know how to, and this is somehow, this thing is the source of all this, it's a psychological difficulty, which that's why writing algebra is better than geometry, because I don't really, I'm going to say now in one word what I have done before, but it doesn't really help, because then you have to really understand what does that mean. So, okay, so now I will write, since I'm short of time, I will write what I said here, at least in words, in the classical version. So now, classical version. Of Mn. In other words, I do define Mn honestly. Now, what you do is the following. You consider now this group scheme A, and you take its nth power. So, namely, you take A to the, you have a map. It's a group scheme over A. So, you have nth power of A over A. And we have the multiplication map. And product and whole multiplication map. It's an abelian group. So now take the kernel. So let R sub n denote this by the kernel of this multiplication map. Okay. So now I retranslate what is written down here in the classical language. I just write a definition. So M sub n is this. I take the Cartesian power of M1, so I take M1 to the n, and then according to this observation over here, whenever I have something with an action with a moment map, which is my M1, I automatically have an action of my group scheme along the fibers. So there is an action of A on this thing, in particular on A1. Well, then when I have n copies, I have an action of A to the n. But now I take the Hamiltonian reduction with respect to this kernel. So I Hamiltonianly reduce all factors except one somehow. And so you see that the number of z's is one less than the number of factors. And that's this kernel. But this, I mean, this is perfectly fine, except that it's not quite, you have to make sense of what I said. So what does that really mean? It's a Hamiltonian reduction with respect to a group scheme. What does that mean? So even if you write it, you have to still define what it means. So what you do is this. You take, so now you can dequantize this formula. So you take M1, and now, first of all, whatever this is maps. Where in this situation, M maps to G star, but this also by the adjoint quotient maps to this G star mod G, which is A. So in particular, when you do this tensor product here, the first thing you could definitely do is just to take only points which map to the same points in the adjoint quotient. Okay. But now we still have to do the second procedure, and then it's clear what to do. The second, as long as they are all sitting over the same A, it makes sense. So now the group A is acting fiber-wise, and now you simply say that the usual fiber product. So when you identify the action of an element of A on this one with the action of the inverse element on this one, and then the action of an element on this here with the next one here, in the commutative case, right and left never show up, it doesn't matter. So altogether, what you are saying is that whenever you have an A, an action of A, you can place it anywhere you like. It will be all the same. Or equivalently, you have an N tuple of elements of A's. As long as their product is one in the group, the applying this N tuple to an element should give the same point. So this is what corresponds to that. So it morally, it's a Hamiltonian reduction with respect to this group scheme, but it's not, I mean, I don't have a universal definition of what that means. So I don't have a, so anyway. Now.
So this is not amended with a projection on A.
So it has a projection to a single copy of A.
Five,
yeah, so maybe I should, how much time do I have? Maybe 5 minutes or? Huh? Okay, so I still wanted to say quite a lot of. So let me just say two things. 10 minutes. Okay, good. Then first of all, let me. It's a beautiful. So in fact, let me finish with this Sicilian story business. The spaces. These are kind of basic ingredients, but one can make a decorated version. Now, and it is already in the paper by Moore and Tachikawa. It's the following. So suppose now I have a sphere S2, but now for each point of for each marked point, I assign an SL2 triple. So at each point I have an SL2 triple. So it's a homomorphism rho I from SL2 to G. And then there should be a space also assigned to this data, and it's natural to denote it by MS2 rho 1 rho n. And now I tell you what it is. It has a very explicit description in this term, and very nice. And maybe you will help me, I don't really understand the meaning of it in terms of num equations. Now I'll be really quick because first of all, the first ingredient in that is the following. So suppose I have just a pair of representations of SL2. So let rho and rho prime be two representations of SL2. Associated to this data, there is a space M rho prime rho, which is, so these are solutions of the num equation. On a segment, on an interval, I don't know, with pole rho at one side, so the boundary condition is rho prime on one side and rho on the other side. And this is, I think, a geometric identification of this with explicit Lie algebraic construction is due to Bilevsky. So I suppose that most of the physics audience know this much better than me. So this is a nice symplectic manifold at zero and rho at one. Okay. Now the point of this story is the following, and that's what I don't quite understand. So now I just write the formula. We take one of these to be a principal nilpotent, and that's what we did before. So now let rho be always principal SL2. And then the point is that, so basically what we did before is we didn't put any boundary condition on the second end. This was the num space that I referred to before. So it had an action of G, and it had a moment map and everything I said. And in particular, there is an action of the centralizer group A. But the centralizer of the group A commutes with G, as I explained it. So the putting the boundary condition at the other end is effectively taking some Hamiltonian reduction by the G action, by something. So in any case, it commutes with an action of A. So there is a residual action of A on whatever you put here, just coming from the principal nilpotent part here. And so there is somehow the point of this construction that there is always a natural picture like this. You have whatever you do, as long as you can put anything here, you put principal nilpotent here, and then you still have a map to this A, and there's an action of the centralizer along the fibers. And I want to think of it as a kind of Hitchin, kind of numb version of the Hitchin system in some sense. Because the only thing is, so in this situation, it's not an integrable system in the sense that the dimension of this is not equal to the twice of dimension of that. So these Hamiltonians commute. So this is like a Hitchin base. But if, so somehow, if rho is equal to rho prime, then indeed it's an integrable. So it's then in fact, it turns out that this is A itself, and this is an integrable, basic integrable system case. But in principle, when rho prime is something else, this dimension of this is bigger. And so this is just a kind of, this not Lagrangian, but I don't know, the pullbacks of functions of here, Poisson commute, and they form Hamiltonian flows. And for instance, it should be, I believe that if you do this duality, so if you go to the mirror side, to the Coulomb branch, you probably want to do the same game with Higgs bundles, which have parabolic structure with the corresponding, it's kind of unipotent parabolic structure with the corresponding representation rho. And then again, then the Hitchin system is no longer integrable. So the dimensions, it's not a Lagrangian fibration. And then you have exact same phenomenon, so they still have the action of the Hitchin base. And this is a kind of one-dimensional baby version of that. And I think that the mirror theorem should move one to the other. So anyway, now in terms of, once you understand this language, the formula is extremely simple. You just put M rho 1 rho times M rho 2 rho, etc. Rho and rho. And again, take the Hamiltonian reduction with respect to this care n. So you a priori they map to different A's, you put them all on the diagonal, copy of A, and then identify the actions of A on various things together. So that's the formula. So maybe kernels would be triple slash. So this is the geometric formula. Now my question is this has to have some interpretation in terms of num equations. So I have an n tuple of num on n intervals with the same boundary condition on one end and different boundary. Can one glue them? And what does this mean in terms of num equations?
I think you can take a star, put all i's boundary conditions at the end. Segments.
But what does it mean to take a star? What?
You take a collection of segments which join at a point.
And what? Well.
So at that point, you say that the bundle is this.
No, I mean this. But is there some geometric setting in which this naturalizes as a sort of? Yeah, so what is, I mean, I could also ask the same on the Higgs side. You can imagine you have parabolic structures of different.
Yeah, so
is there a way to,
I
would like to something like in this ball varieties where you merge segments in some clever way. I mean, it should have some meaning, but I don't know what is it.
No. This is fish.
So I emphasize that you have the same. There is a similar question on the global curve on the Higgs side.
Yes.
So you can do exactly the same. You have several parabolic structures, and you just do the same procedure. You identify the images in the Higgs in the Hitchin base, and then mod out by the action of the abelian on this group. And that also, what does it mean? I mean, is there any meaning for that?
But why are you not happy with the original answer?
No, I mean, formally I'm happy. I don't know. There is no formal question. The question is there any geometric setting in which this arises naturally?
There's a picture of the geometric setting. The Hitchin system on a sphere with those poles.
No, but I'm doing a strange thing. I'm doing some strange reduction for a certain subgroup. For instance, why don't I, if I mod out, for instance, not by the kernel, but the whole group, I get nothing.
So I do not understand the meaning of this operation, which takes regular number of poles and erases them. I'd love to understand it. I don't.
So anyway, maybe I will take 2 minutes to explain, since I didn't get anything. I just say a few words without basically writing anything, on about how what is the geometry behind the Gelfand-Gryff theorem. I did the classical version for this, so what is the geometry of the Gelfand-Gryff version? Now here, I just, since I really have 2 minutes, I will explain basically what happens. Now, the main point is this, that, so we are now in this, the issue is, as I explained, is the genuine cotangent bundle on G-mod-U versus this psi cotangent bundle of G-mod-U. Now, the story here is as follows. On one hand, this is something very familiar. It's the cotangent bundle to something. It's a nice thing. But this space is not affine because G mod U is not affine. It's quasi-affine. So if you look at the space of functions, it's something. And for instance, it's not obvious, and I can prove it, but it's not obvious at all, that the ring of functions is finitely generated. So in fact, the space has an affine closure, a well-defined affine variety. And this variety is extremely interesting. And what the classical version of Gelfand-Gryff theorem says, that there is a W action on this space, but it does not preserve, you cannot remove the bar. The bar, the unbarred set is not W stable. Okay? Now, this space is, although there's a psi, but so on the nose it's kind of a little more complicated, but in fact, geometrically it's much nicer. It's an affine smooth manifold. So all these algebraic geometric issues never show up. It's just an affine space times the group. So there are no issues whatsoever. And somehow, but this space is extremely interesting and nobody apparently considered it. I cannot resist it. I will try to explain what it is for SL3 because it's really something beautiful. So the point is this, that for instance, we know, G mod U itself is already not affine, but it has the affine closure. And this is basically the Plucker embedding, right? Now, but this space has an enormously rich structure. So since we have the projection from T star G mod U to G mod U, so the affine closures induce this map. But now you have a W action. So in fact, you have W many ways to project this space to here. And they're all completely symmetric. Now, for SL3, the picture is very amusing. So for SL3, so we have two fundamental representations, so C2 and, three-dimensional on the dual one. And so the Plucker embedding is, the usual Plucker embedding is to map to one copy of the first representation and to one copy of the second, and there are Plucker relations. Now for this one, you have three copies of the first fundamental representation and three copies of this second fundamental representation, and they are mapped. And so the data is as follows. So this a point, so the Plucker embedding of this space looks at for SL3 is the following data. So you take V1, V2, V3. So these are vectors in C3. So this is the first fundamental representation. Now you also have a triple of bivectors. Let me denote them by U1, 2, U2, 3, and U1, 3. So these are in wedge 2, C3. And there are also, remember this comes from some cotangent bundle. So there's an operator, by the moment map, it maps to some element of G, and in particular some eigenvalues. And so the data that is relevant here are the eigenvalues. So there are also complex numbers, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, C. So these are the coordinates, and they are subject to some sort of Plucker relations, but the relations are interchanging all this in this funny way. And this is really very nice. So whenever you see a genuine candidate for G mod U, you impose the relation. So for instance, if you have V1 wedge U1, 2, this is 0. And if you have V1 wedge V2, U1, 2, it's also 0. So you write all these, but there are some cases where they are not 0. For instance, you can write V1 wedge U2, 3. Okay? But so now, since we're in the SL3, there's a preferred volume element in wedge 3 of C3. So let's call it volume. Uh, And then the remaining equations are kind of a mixture of the moment map equations and the Plucker equations. It says that, so in this particular case, you have to have this to be equal, lambda 1 minus lambda 2, lambda 1 minus lambda 3 times volume. And then you do it for all things. So somehow, this is the denominator. You cannot somehow, otherwise you would be able to, so U2, 3 is almost V1 wedge V2 wedge V3. So generically, it is expressible until as this, but at the poles, you make a resolution. And that's it. For SL3, you can prove that that's a complete structure. And so the wild group, I mean, the symmetric group on three letters on the nodes permutes all these data. So we conjecture, so one can write similar relations for SLN. I don't know whether this is a complete list. An important conjecture, which I have absolutely no idea, is that, in fact, this variety has symplectic singularities, which is not, I'm pretty sure it does not have symplectic resolution. But there's a weakest property, which introduced by Bovill, which says that so it means that symplectic singularities which means that if you there is or equivalent for any resolution of singularities, the symplectic form, the pullback of the symplectic form extends without poles, but possibly as a degenerate form on the resolution. And this implies that, for instance, there should be finitely many symplectic leaves, which when then one can try to study. So
this is supposed to be the same as M3?
No. This is a separate story. This is Gelfand-Greif, a classical Gelfand-Greif story.
Right.
It has nothing to do. At this point, these two things are unrelated. I just wanted to attract this attention. Nobody seems to ever looked at this variety, and this is very beautiful, and I do think it deserves lots of studies. I mean, okay.
No. Okay. Any questions?
Is there an associated traditional
To what?
To your
No, I mean.
I mean, you can take something.
No, I mean, these two stories are not really, no, at this point I didn't mean to say that this Gelfand-Greif story is related to the other story.
Yeah, but I mean that your original
Moore and Tachikara. So honestly, I don't remember why did we, so definitely we. I was reading this paper by Moore and Tachikara, and then we discussed it with Kasdan. How did we decide that this has something to do with Gelfand-Greif? I honestly don't remember. Maybe one thing I want to say is that one link can be this, but I cannot prove anything. So in fact, some of the physics papers, I don't remember whether it was Tachikawa himself or maybe, there is a formula for a conjectural character formula for the ring of functions on this MN. So there's a natural action, I mean, the group actions, in the case where you have this M on this. Now, then you have a natural action of the centralizers of all of these rows. So these are reductive groups, and there's also a C-star action. So you can ask for a graded character formula, and there is a huge complicated formula. Now, in the simplest case where, if you look at the formula, it involves whole Littlewood polynomials. Just that's how it's written. Now, if you put all these zeros here, the formula is greatly simplified because all these centralizers become G itself. The formula still makes sense. And I have no idea how the physicists came up with this formula. But in any case, at least I believe that when you put all the rows to be trivial, then I can prove this formula. And the proof really uses this. Because what you do, you kind of, I didn't explain this, but if you take psi to be zero, so there's a precise relation in which this is related to that. And now on the cotangent bundle of G mod U, it's not affine or anything, but it reduces to the Springer resolution G tilde. And we know what is the character formulas for functions on G tilde. And now if you do the translation, you exactly get the formula conjectured by in that paper, it's a non-trivial statement because, I'm just saying that computing characters of, it's basically computing characters of bundles on the lambda on the flag manifold G mod B pulled back to the cool tension bundle to G mod B. So in particular, you have to know that unless the bond, when the weight is dominant, it's easy to compute because there's no high cohomology, but the weight may not be dominant. And in fact, you see from this W symmetric picture that you cannot impose any condition on the weight. So somehow you have to keep track of all the possible W's, but still one can figure out what's going on. And that's the way to prove the character formula for the psi, for zeros. For non-zeros, I believe that there should be something similar, but at least when the elements are, as usual in this business, it's important where the elements are regular in a Levy or not. So, and basically when they're not, then everybody is stuck, as far as I understand. Yes.
Is this purely a T of zero, or was it
a T of zero? Well, it's a T of T. So in a sense, when as long as the axioms are satisfied, you have, you know that. I don't know a closed formula how to. Probably, I don't know. This is not a question to me. It's a question to TQFT people. So. I believe that since the formula, that's why I'm asking, since the formula is a kind of a fusion itself of some num solutions, there should be a way to say it intrinsically for a genus.
Each handle could be probably added to that formula.
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah, but it would be, of course, nice to make it not just artificially putting skeleta on the surface, but to actually do some geometric. But anyway, so there are many questions. I also had everything I said has a mirror on the using the geometric Sataki in terms of the affine Grassmannian, but obviously I don't have time to explain this.
I think you were asking about flagging both. So I was asking, I wanted to see two of these glued into a pair of pads, whereas you glued together, essentially, by like internally glued
them. You did show them once, right? Inside that formula, and you glue them by taking the.
So yeah, so if
you get some other known space, which we handle.
For instance, if you glue one puncture with itself, so get a sphere without punctures, it will be just A itself. This is what was known at the beginning, and this is what you get from the formula.
Glue meaning?
I don't have a closed expression. But
there must be an ingredient you can add to that that just has a handle.
Yeah.
So that's adding a puncture. So each of these and ones that you're adding in that format adds an extra puncture, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to add two punctures and glue them, you're adding a handle.
Yeah.
So there should be if you take another space, you just two A action.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of one A action, put it in there.
In a sense, I don't know, there are two actions because, basically I only use the action coming from one end, but there is also an A action coming from the other end.
You take M of rho from a rho, regular.
Yeah. There's an special coincidence. So if you take rho and rho here, then you do have two actions, but they are the same because this is just the action of A on itself, which is commutative. It's an accident. Because A itself is commutative. So its own action on itself on the left and on the right is the same action. It's a special feature. In general, you still have some freedom of playing with gauge group on the rho prime side, but it's more, I don't really know what to say about it. So anyway, I think it's too late.
I had a couple of observations.